The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start by 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to this special edition and special time for our Tuesday Space Show program. Great to be here. Another terrific guest planned for you today. So let me run through the announcements. The first thing I want to say is that we're on the 60-minute format this morning. Both the guest and I have later travel plans and things, so we're kind of squeaking this program in because it's an important one. And that's why it's at 8 a.m. California time. But we are on the 60-minute format, so please watch your clock. And if you want to get in an email question or give us a call on the toll-free line, please make sure you do it within our Tuesday morning time constraints. Our toll-free number, for those of you who do want to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. And remember, there are no call screeners, so just be patient, and we will bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also send email to us, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and you can also post a comment or question for our guest on the blog. And again, that is at our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right, the upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed. And that is also our archive page and blog page for this show. So open it up, and comments are down at the bottom. As soon as you post your comment, I will be able to get it in integrated into our discussion this morning. But again, the toll-free number is our preferred way, 1-866-687-7223. Just to call your attention to a few other things, we do have a left upper menu. So if you're interested in Space Show logo wear, look under support and you'll see our Cafe Press store. We also have an area called Listen Live in that upper left corner, and that tells you how to listen to live Space Show programs, compressed MP3s as archives on our website, and also the podcast version of our show, including those that are on Alexa. So if you have any questions about any of this, please email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And feel free to share this information with other people. And then do remember that the Space Show is your financed program. We're a 501c3 with giantleapfoundation.org. And we bring you these programs because many of you do financially support the Space Show. So we are a nonprofit, as I said, 501c3. Our parent is giantleapfoundation.org. If you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction. We're a public benefit corporation in California. And we couldn't do these programs without your financial support. So we deeply appreciate it and need it. So if you have any questions, check out giantleapfoundation.org or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we thank you very much for your support. I guess what else I want to tell you is we are trademarked. We are copyrighted. You have permission to download and share all of our programming, although it's much easier to share a URL than it is a full program. And there are a couple of rules about that, and one is not to do anything commercial. Another one is no edits, cuts, clips, especially on any other websites, such as YouTube or even your own. And we don't permit written transcripts, at least not at this time, and even if they're for your own personal use. Our full copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our website pages, including thespaceshow.com and onegiantleapfoundation.org. And if you have any questions or you want to use something from a Space Show program, simply email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and we'll do our best to work out something with you, and we deeply appreciate that. Remember, we are podcasting, and Gigadial is our client, and you can find us on iTunes and a host of other services. And if you have any podcasting questions or device questions, I'm probably not really good at offering you device help on how to resolve something with your computer or your smartphone or a tablet or something else, but I'll give it a good try. Email me about your problem. And I appreciate that, and as I said, I'll do my best to respond to you. We also have sponsors. Because this is a shorter format program, I'm not going to read sponsor messages, but I will mention each and every one of them and thank them, because we couldn't be doing this program without our sponsors. And remember, sponsors get a banner ad running across our website, and they can change that banner ad as often as they like. So we do thank the National Space Society as a sponsor. Also, the Space Development Network, which is seeking to do work and to spread the word about space settlement. The Space Foundation is our sponsor, and we appreciate that. The Integrated Space Plan at thespaceplan.com. AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, is on board with us. And then also Celestis, which is the only provider of Memorial spaceflight services in the world. So we deeply appreciate our sponsors and their continued help and support of the Space Show program. And that brings me to today's guest. And again, we're very happy to bring back to the show Rob Kelso. So he is a degreed aerospace manager, senior executive. He has more than 35 years of experience in NASA and the aerospace industry. He led the Hawaiian State Government Pacific International Space Center for Exploration Systems, PISCES. In fact, that was what he was doing the last time he was a guest on the show, and he was their executive director. He's led legislative affairs between Hawaii's state legislature, congressional legislature, and the Hawaii governor's office for PISCES. He led strategic initiatives within federal government for engaging lunar commercial space capability to complement government efforts. He's directed manned spaceflight missions, at least 25 of them, as the NASA Shuttle Flight Director. He now has Kelso Aerospace Engineering, and he's got a focus, and we can talk about this, on the technologies for construction of habitats and what we do when we get back to the moon. And yes, we are going back to the moon, listeners, and when we get to Mars. And he's also been working with the South Koreans in these construction capabilities and technologies as well. Rob, welcome back to the show. How are you this morning?
Great, David, and it is always such a pleasure to be a part of your popular show. It is a joy to be back with you.
Well, and it's great to have you back with us, too. So, technologies for construction on the moon and Mars, are they comparable, the moon and Mars, or do you have one set of technologies and methodologies for the moon and a totally other set for Mars? And just thinking about the gravity and the surface differences would make me think you almost have to have two different kinds of technologies.
Yeah, in many ways, though, they're very similar in those type of technologies. So I think this discussion today, which I term paving the way to planetary settlement, and paving being a key word here, as you see, is not a accident that I use the word paving, but it'll play an important part in this whole philosophy and methodology for settling back on Moon and Mars. I think it'll be an extremely interesting topic for you and the listeners, as well as not just being visionary, but having near-term flight opportunity, near-term flight opportunities that are rapidly coming up that allow us to begin to move forward within this and not just thinking about it, but doing it. And I would start by saying that for hundreds of years, mankind has thought and dreamed of living on the other world, whether that's the moon or Mars. This has always been a thought of what it would be like to live somewhere else off the Earth. And, of course, in the 1950s, there were a lot of books that dealt with planetary settlement and bases on the moon. There was a book called Moon Base by William Nephew and Michael Chester, and another book called City on the Moon by Murray Leinster. And then who wasn't so excited a number of years ago when The Martian came out by best-selling author Andy Weir of an astronaut in the movie Matt Damon, being stranded on Mars, left for dead, but survived, and then having survived, would have to thrive on the planet Mars. And so we got a real sense of what it might be like to live and to settle on Mars. So I think a major tenet in my thinking and in many people is that planetary settlement is not a question of if, but rather when, that it is going to happen. It's just, when is this going to happen? And I'm, in addition to formerly being with NASA and then now with Kelso Aerospace, I'm also a director on the board of directors for the National Space Society. And, of course, a major theme within NSS is planetary settlement, is space settlement. So this concept of settlement has been around for hundreds of years, and now I think we're at the cusp of seeing some real movement, including spaceflight opportunities, to deal with that. And I'll address that with you today.
Okay.
You remember, and there were some recent press stories on this as well, 66 million years ago, an asteroid hit in the southern part of the Gulf of Mexico, creating this huge upwelling of dust that clouded the Earth from solar radiation and light, and also huge tsunamis that wiped out three-fourths of the Earth's life, including the dinosaurs. And some people comically say that the dinosaurs became extinct because they didn't have a space program. But we do. And, you know, a number of reasons for planetary settlement, whether that be on the moon or Mars, some of those deal with human sustainability, becoming a multi-planet species to diversify our risk so that if and when another huge planetary catastrophic event happens, like 66 million years ago, the human race is not wiped out. We've got a risk mitigation plan that has humans settled in other places where humanity can continue. And many people debate whether we should settle on the moon, go directly to the moon and don't worry about Mars, or go to Mars and don't worry about the moon. And you see different approaches, both technically and philosophically, across the community on that debate. I and other scientists and engineers favor going to Mars, but by way of the moon, using the moon since it's close, 3 days away versus 9 months to a year away from Mars, to develop and prototype many of the systems and the techniques that we need for settling on Mars, but demonstrating and developing those capabilities at the moon. But also, the moon is so much different than it was even when we were back in Apollo. We thought the moon was not only airless, but waterless, and how wrong we were. Even as late as the 1980s, we began to see that there was actually water on the moon. And now with many of the orbital satellites around the moon, we know that there's tremendous amounts of water on the moon, perhaps 10 billion metric tons, enough water in one of the poles to fill the Great Salt Lake in Utah. So the question is, you know, how do we get at that water? And what is the state of that water? We really don't know. We know it exists, that it's there, but we don't know the state of the water. Is it bound up in chunks of ice or solid blocks of ice, or is it fairy castle type of snow where individual water molecules bind on to various single or multiple grains of the regolith on the moon? We really don't know what the state of the water is, nor do we know the lateral and vertical distribution of the water. How deep does it go? How wide does it go across? And so in many ways, we need ground truth like we saw with the proposed Lunar Prospector, Resource Prospector mission that was recently canceled, to get at the moon and begin to verify ground truth of what's there. But the water is a key element in providing new capabilities for us. But this whole concept of planetary settlement deals with a major premise that we must change the way we think. When we look at the space station, by the way, is operated and developed and maintained, is Earth reliant. It relies on resupply from the Earth of propellant, of air, of water, of crews. It is totally reliant on Earth for resupply. But we can't operate in that type of model when we go to the moon and Mars. Instead of Earth reliant, we have to become Earth independent. And there's a fancy term that has been floating for a number of years out there that characterize that, and it's called in-situ resource utilization, ISRU. Big word, but meaning live off the land, using the indigenous materials that are located in where you are going to sustain you and use that for building the infrastructures that you need at those locations. You had mentioned at the beginning of the show that I was the executive director out in Hawaii at a robotic test facility called Pisces for a number of years. And one of the things that I learned from the Hawaiians were that the Hawaiians in the Isles, the ancient Hawaiians, really understood this thought of ISRU, of living off the land. When they settled in Hawaii maybe 600, 700, 800 years ago from Polynesia, in the Polynesian voyaging canoes, they didn't bring everything they would need to exist for years and years with them in those canoes. They brought just enough supplies to do the journey, and once they landed in the Isles of Hawaii, they lived off the land. They used the trees there for canoes. They used the food there. But more importantly, they used the lava, the volcanic material on the islands, for building material, for their walkways, for the foundations and structures, for shelters. Their tools all were of indigenous material. So in many ways, in my thinking, the Polynesian voyagers coming into Hawaii were our first astronauts. Up until that point, man had migrated across the continents through land bridges, moving up from Africa into Europe, across Asia, and the Asian land bridge into the upper part of North America, then down through North America and South America. But all of that movement was through land bridges. But here, for the first time, we see transportation and voyaging of these early astronauts, if you will, across the vast oceans, using the waves and the wind, the moon and the sun, and most importantly, the stars, to do precision navigation in moving and settling in the Isles of Hawaii. So this concept of in-situ resource utilization is paramount and thematic in our discussion of planetary settlement. And it's got two main components, and I want to hit those briefly and then center on the second one, which is the focus of most of my effort. A lot of the discussion within NASA and other groups and recent press releases deal with the first one, and that's the volatiles, the water and hydroxyls that are on the moon, and the water that we see bound up on Mars. So the first big theme in ISRU has been lunar consumables. getting at the hydrogen and oxygen in the water. If you can get to the water, you can differentiate between the molecules by breaking them apart in water into the components of hydrogen and oxygen, and you can breathe the oxygen, you can drink the water, but also you can use the hydrogen oxygen for fuel cell reactors to power the generators for not only the settlement but for robotic systems. But most importantly, in using the hydrogen and oxygen for propellant, hydrogen and oxygen are the most energy efficient and powerful of all the propellants that we know of today. So a major part of discussions recently has been in ISRU relative to volatiles. But I think there's been a lack of discussion, a lack of emphasis in the second area, which is of greatest interest to me and a major focus for the work I do and the speaking I do, and that's in the area of lunar construction. When we build things on Moon and Mars, we're not going to go over to Lowe's and bring a boatload of lumber and building material and nails and brackets and launch those from Earth to Moon or Mars. It's just not going to happen. It's not efficient in launch weight performance. It's so expensive to do it that way. So the thought here is to use the indigenous material on Moon and Mars to do that construction, using the basalt material for building roads, for landing pads, for infrastructures, coverings for radiation. And, you know, what fascinates me is that we need a whole new set of building codes. We need a whole new set of construction standards. What does it mean to have load-bearing and non-load-bearing walls in 1/6 G on the Moon and 1/4 G on Mars? So building standards and codes are going to be a fascinating discussion of how we translate current terrestrial buildings and codes into those similar type of codes for use on Moon and Mars. But, you know, when you build a structure or a house here on Earth, one of the first things they do is go out and survey the land and look at the material that is the part of the base foundation. They do core drillings to see if you're building on top of a void or a sinkhole, which would not be good. Fortunately, the White House hopefully is not built on top of a sinkhole, as we've seen in the grounds of the White House recently. But you want to do core drilling to make sure that you're building on top of solid material. And, of course, the Moon is covered with cavernous material, lunar lava tubes. And we know they exist on Mars as well. So you want to do core drillings as a part of the site surveys to make sure that you're building on top of good solid material. And so you need drilling technology to do much of that. What's interesting to me is that many of the technologies for construction that we take for granted here terrestrially on Earth is really unknown to us for Moon and Mars. We don't know how to drill on Moon and Mars, except for small little holes like we see off the Curiosity rover. We don't know how to do anchoring in construction. We don't even know how to make the first brick on the Moon or Mars out of the indigenous material. But when we think of building these type of infrastructures, I think it comes into a couple of types of technologies that are needed. One is in sintering or surface stabilization, and the other is in 3D printing. So when we do the roads and the base foundations for landing pads, more than likely we'll be doing sintering. Like microwaving the surface with a microwave lawnmower through powered by a very powerful 50-kilowatt generator to stabilize the surface. A major issue both on Moon and Mars is dust. And the blowing of dust within ascent and descent landers is a major issue. And so you want to stabilize the surface, and I think we'll use these microwave lawnmowers or rovers to build these roads and base foundations for landing pads. But then when you do more vertical construction, it won't be so much in sintering. It will be in 3D printing of pressurized habitats and unpressurized habitats. For example, you might have a large doghouse as a storage facility for your rovers, but build a pressurized vessel over the habitat or enclosure for inflatable systems like the Bigelow 330 inflatable structure module. And so 3D printing is also going to be a key aspect of this construction. But I'm pushing for more discussion, more dialogue in the construction aspect to catch up with the discussions ongoing with the volatiles for the surface. And the reason is that when we look back at Apollo, we had the Gemini program that is often overlooked and forgotten as the technology demonstrator for going to the moon. Gemini was in and of itself the program where we developed the tools and the methodologies and techniques by which we would go to the moon. We used Gemini for developing the technologies for the fuel cell in manned spaceflight for the first time, for doing extravehicular activity, spacewalks for the first time, for developing the tools for rendezvous, proximity operations, and docking of multiple spacecraft together was done in Gemini for Apollo, long-duration spaceflight in Gemini. But not just in the manned program. We saw it in the unmanned program in getting ready for the Apollo program, in the concept, for example, of the Surveyor spacecraft in 1966. Main reason for Surveyor was technology demonstration, was to see if we could soft land on the surface of the moon, and the moon could support that type of weight of spacecraft leading to the Apollo landing. Up until that point, we really didn't know if the surface could support a lander, including the Apollo lander, or would it settle into a quagmire of dust and sink into the soil? We really just didn't know. So a major technology demonstration for Surveyor was, can you land on the surface of the moon and the surface support the weight of the lander, of course, which it did. But when we look at today's environment, one of the issues that I've had with my former agency, NASA, was there was no flight demonstration for developing and proving technology that we need for this eventual settlement for Moon and Mars, a part of the agency's agenda in the past. It was never there. There was work done in ground prototypes and ground testing, but not in flight testing like we saw in Gemini and in Surveyor. So the flight test program was missing from our global approach. But I think now what we're seeing is a new revelation with the Trump administration and Administrator Bidenstine of not only that moon is back on the table, that we want to go to the moon, but that we need a technology development program that begins flight-level testing of programs to develop and mature the technologies that we need for planetary settlement on Moon and Mars, but that we have no idea how to do. Right, the ones I mentioned before of anchoring, of drilling, of making a brick on them, and so on and so forth. So this has become a major focal point for me in the work that I do and also within the work that I'm doing with South Korea. And that leads into three interesting flight programs that I'll share briefly with you, and then I'll pause and we can redirect or go on to other different topics.
Yeah, because I've got a lot of questions coming in that are
good.
For you. So.
Well, I'll quickly summarize these three flight programs, and then we'll go to that. So, again, I've been interested in how do we do flight testing of some of these technologies that we really don't know what to do. As I mentioned, dust is a major issue on Moon and Mars. We've all seen these pictures of Mars Exploration Rover that is taken by its mass camera, and it's just the solar rays and the radiator are covered by Mars dust until, fortunately, every once in a while, the dust devil, little tornado, comes by and sweeps clean the dust off the solar rays and radiators and restores the efficiencies of those systems for maintaining and operating the rover systems. Dust was the number one issue on the moon from the Apollo astronauts. They got into bearings and joints. It was all over the spacesuits. And so instead of having a clean white spacesuit that rejected the heat radiation from the sun and allowed you to stay cool in the suit, the regolith would bind and stick, given that the regolith is not soft like talcum powder. It's the size of talcum powder, but not soft like talc. It's crushed glass in many respects, very fine glass, and it has many shards and barbs in it that stick and hold into the material. So the Apollo suits became very dark and brown, which attracted more radiation into the suit, which meant there needed to be more water used in the suit for maintaining the thermal cooling that the astronaut would need. And then it upgrazed all over the camera lenses. You remember in the latter Apollo missions, 15, 16, and 17, they would have to take the brush on the lunar rover vehicle and sweep clean the little radiator off the LRV and clean the camera lens off the camera of the LRV and brush themselves and brush the dust off of their visor. In fact, Harrison Smith by the third EVA on Apollo 17 said that the shards had so scratched his outer gold visor that it became almost very difficult to see through it. So dust was a major issue in the Apollo program, and we see this in Mars as well. So I'm working with the Kennedy Space Center on a flight project called the Electrodynamic Dust System, which uses a dynamic electric field to energize this extremely fine particles of dust and reject them, throw them off, cast them off of the coating. So the concept is to put a thin film coating of this electric field material, these a coil, if you will, and over radiators and solar rays or visors or the spacesuit material. And if you get coated with dust, you turn it on and boom, you're clean, like Mr. Clean. But we've never tested this on the moon and Mars, only in laboratories. So I've put together a team that includes not only Kennedy Space Center, who's developing that technology, but two Hawaiian high schools that are part of that project that will actually build flight hardware, both for ground testing and flight, for testing on the surface of the moon. And we hope to have that small experiment package, ISRU technology demonstrator, that would fly on the first commercial lunar landing mission. So we're very excited about the electronic or electrodynamic dust shield that we called Moon Riders, given that we have two Hawaii high schools involved. Riders being removal of removal instrument for dust systems, riders. The second flight program that I'm involved with is looking at basalt as a radiation barrier. If you look at most of the concepts and the writings, there's interest in using the indigenous material on Moon and Mars not only for thermal protection, but also radiation protection, whether you build these bricks or pavers and then put them over the shelters, or you berm up the material loosely and bury these habitats under the material, the thermal protection and radiation protection might be provided by the lunar dust, either in bricks or as you pile it up, both for Moon and Mars. Radiation is a major risk that we see at both locations, both at the moon and Mars. But what we don't know is how effective basalt is as an irradiation shield for the radiation at both environments. So I've been working on a flight program that looks at flying small basalt samples, some just with pure basalt, other with basalt and a polymer additive, which is not only good as a binding agent for the basalt, but also has good properties for radiation shielding, and test those on the surface of the moon or in lunar orbit or around Mars orbit with dosimeters to give you a feel for both the energy of the particles that are able to get through the basalt shield the identification of the particle and the direction of the particle, those three things, so that we can determine how efficient is basalt as a shielding agent in efficiently serving as a shield for radiation. So that's the second ISRU flight program that I'm looking at. And the third one that's interesting to me is, how do we make the first brick on the moon? We've got all this lunar material. We say we want to build structures and infrastructure with the material, but we don't know how to make the first brick. And so I'm interested in a probe flight program for a small little experiment that would make the first brick on the moon. How exciting is it going to be when we see the first water drop that comes from the volatiles or the ice on the moon, but also the first brick that would be made on the moon? So these are three near-term flight programs that we are working on that hopefully we can get to the surface of the moon to begin to test these technologies that are required for planetary settlement. And with that, I'll kind of pause and let's see where we are.
Okay, so I do have a couple of questions. So Tim is in Denver, Colorado, and he says there have been several engineers of various persuasions on David's show talking about lunar HABs and how to get started and what to do, and it seems like overwhelmingly they talk about initially using rigid structures sitting on the surface of the moon and bringing power to them and connecting them in different ways and pressurizing them and shielding them by putting several meters of lunar regolith on top of them as the shielding. They all say they don't have the technology to go underground or to do something more complex for this. They do think that this could be done within 10 or 12 years if we actually had a program to go back and land on the moon and to have a settlement or an outpost to stay. Is that a valid approach given what you've been talking about?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I have a great question. And almost all of the writing that I see and the discussions that I have and in what order that you build these outposts or settlements, they all begin robotically, David,
right,
before humans arrive. So it's totally different than we did Apollo. And so you send these robots first off to do the reconnaissance and surveying for where's the best place to live. You know, I mentioned site surveillance for construction before, same analogy that we do these terrestrial systems, and then to find where's the best place to get at the water. So once you find that location, I think the first thing that's going to happen are these robotic systems that begin to pave the way, hence going back to the title of our discussion of paving the way for planetary settlement. These robotic systems would begin to put in that basic infrastructure. Primarily, first off, is in building a landing pad. We have to be able to center and build a soil-stable landing pad so we can do vertical takeoff, vertical landings of rocket systems as we bring materials into the site. So I think the first thing that we'll see is a large power system lander, a 50-kilowatt system that can provide the power for not only the rovers, but also for example, these klystrons for microwave systems for building initially these roads and the landing pads. But you have to build that first. The landing pad is going to be the first infrastructure that we do before you build these other structures. And we see that, and I'll digress just for a second from what we saw in Apollo. In Apollo, when the lander landed, we excavated many tons of lunar material, but at extremely high speeds. Because there's the vacuum on the moon or near vacuum on Mars, we get extremely high velocity particles that are created and aerolifted by the descent or ascent engines in going to these outposts. In fact, the velocities that we saw in Apollo were up to 2,000 meters per second for very fine particles, which is almost the escape velocity from the moon. So we don't have the atmosphere of Earth here that create these billowing clouds. They come out as a very flat sheet, very dense, and at high velocities. So the risk here is that if you don't have a stabilized landing pad and you've got all these shelters or you've got all these robotic systems, communication antennas, solar arrays, and you bring these landers in, this high-velocity blowing dust sheets will decimate these infrastructures that you're trying to build. It'll be many, many times worse than our most powerful sandblasters. So the landing pad, the stabilized surface for landing and takeoff of these lander systems will be paramount. And then we start adding the other infrastructures. There's a lot of discussion going on how you do the habitat. Many favor, as the listener pointed out, in an expandable system or inflatable system like the Bigelow module, and then you cover it with regolith or the thermal shielding. Others think, and there's good evidence to think it's an interesting approach, and we saw this in some of the Mars books, is finding these lava tubes and living down into these lava tubes where it's more thermally benign and also you have radiation shielding. So there's, depending on where you land and the capabilities there of lava tubes or not lava tubes will help drive the infrastructure there. But I think we will be seeing the 3D printing, like we do of houses with conduit, at Moon and Mars. Even if you build it over a lava tube, there will be certain infrastructure that will be built above ground in these structures that will come into play. So you could very well have an above ground and below ground type of model. One of the groups that we're about to work with from Korea that we're in a project proposal to the Korean Science Ministry is the relatively new space agency in the United Arab Emirates, UAE. A number of years ago, they created the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Center in the Emirates. And they have set as a goal the Mars City 2017. And you can Google that to see some of the thoughts that they see architecturally for that, hoping to have some type of human permanent colony on the red planet by the year 2117. So they've done some work with the Bark Ingels Group, BIG, from Europe, in doing the architecture for building a Mars Science City outside of Dubai. So it's beginning to look at how do you do this construction of habitat and pressurized and unpressurized shelters here on Earth, but doing that in these Earth analogs to develop the technologies that you would then test on Moon and Mars. So we're interested in doing the construction part with the Bark Ingels Group, the Danish company, doing the architecture part of that. And we're hoping to kick that off if the contract is awarded here in June. That project would start in beginning in July. So we're very excited about that.
Let me give you another question because I know we're going to be short on time. So this is Sally in Seattle. And she says, I've been listening, and while I think everything about what you're saying is essential, probably as mandatory as you can make something mandatory without passing a law for it, the real problem, as I see it, is that there is a lot of rhetoric and a lot of promises by government, including NASA, that we're going to go back to the moon and we're going to go to stay. But I really don't see that happening. For example, there's very little coming out of NASA to support what you're talking about. At least it's not visible. People don't see any of this advanced work being done. Number two, we are going to be diverted from going to the surface of the moon by LOP G, and many believe that that diversion will end up being permanent, and that no matter what the plans are and the promises for going to the surface of the moon later in the 2020s, late in the 2020s, it won't happen. And some of that is budget reasons, and some of that is just the nature of the beast. So do you actually see us going back to the moon, landing on the surface, doing something somehow to stay? And is that going to happen in any kind of reasonable time period? And if the moon is the path to Mars, if we don't ever get our act together and actually land on the moon and do some of the things and develop the technologies that you and others talk about, since it's the pathway to the Mars, I assume Mars will just be kicked down the road indefinitely as well. What do you have to say about this? There's just no timeline that makes any sense to any of this.
So I think that's a great question and a lot of frustration. There's a lot of frustration out there. But I think things are rapidly changing, and I think they're changing within the NASA administration as well. So let me respond to it in twofold. There are people that support LOPG, and there are people that oppose to that. But if it happens, as I mentioned, one of the things that are critical to these settlements at the moon, beginning to build this infrastructure, is that it would initially be built robotically. So we saw back in Apollo, you know, it's a second and a half for a command to get there and a second and a half to get back. So there's a slight time delay in commanding robotic systems from the Earth. If you have a man-tended capability at LOPG, and we add in laser communications capability for high bandwidth commanding of robotic systems, totally different than what we do on Mars, then we can begin to do man-tended robotic work from these lunar outposts like LOPG and building the initial capabilities on the lunar surface. Now, the other thing that is totally different that has changed with the new administration, Trump, and now Bridenstine as the administrator, is that NASA has instituted the Commercial Lunar Payload Services program. And there's two groups that are working this now within the agency under this new lunar exploration program within NASA. It's across two mission directories. So one is in the Science Mission Directorate, and that's where this new contracting mechanism is now ongoing. There's a draft RFP that is out with the formal RFP coming out in July for soliciting commercial lunar providers, U.S.-based commercial lunar providers that can provide the landing services to get some of this technology to the surface beginning as early as 2021. That's what the new contract says. They want the first mission to be done with technology flown, science, maybe some science instruments, maybe some of the instruments from Lunar Resource Prospector, some of the instruments I've been talking about, before the end of 2021 on the first mission. And there's a lot of emphasis within the administration to show that you can get to the moon and begin doing some things on the surface using these commercial lunar lander companies before the end of the first administration four-year term. And so NASA has released this Commercial Lunar Payload Services, CLPS, C-L-P-S, which is an IDIQ contract method for soliciting and awarding payloads that would fly both for science and technology to the surface. So this is real. This is new. This is hasn't been there before, and NASA is now interested in taking advantage of these emerging commercial landers to the lunar surface so that we can begin to do some of the technology development for ISRU and the other things that we have never done before. So to me, this is very exciting that we can now begin in the next couple of years actual flight testing on the lunar surface that begin paving the way through technology development of these eventual planetary systems. Now, when would be the timeline for escalating that, maturing that into these larger outposts? You know, that hasn't been put to the timetable yet. Obviously, in Europe, the ESA, there is a large emphasis on creating a lunar village. Jeff Bezos just the other day at ISDC talked about his interest in providing commercial lunar landers and helping to facilitate infrastructure for an outpost on the moon, and would do that with or without NASA. So so I think we're seeing a total shift now, and just instead of just talking about it and doing that, that's going to advent by 2021. And so I think once we begin to get this foothold and actually get to the surface and begin doing things, it's going to provide a motivation and impetus to move on more and more eventually toward a settlement type of capability.
Let me give you another question. Roger's in Los Angeles, and he says, Rob, it appears to me that in a way you're sort of let me see how to change his wording a little bit. I'm going to change it because I don't want to use his language on air. It seems to me that you're, in a way, criticizing many of the lunar settlement space advocates who say and repeat and blog and continue to comment that we could be on the moon with lunar settlements very, very quickly, and that everything else is a delay, and why doesn't NASA bleep, 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 really get off the ball and do that? Maybe a commercial company will actually do it. But it seems to me you're putting so many technology, testing, trial, exploration type of roadblocks in that path that you're making what the advocates talk about doing not very feasible. So there seems to be a gap between what you're advocating as to how we go about getting back to the moon and how many space advocates, many of whom are, by the way, members of the National Space Society, advocate. Mm-hmm. Can you explain the gap, and what can you do, or what can anyone do, to perhaps provide more realism to space advocacy so that it's not so much driven by dreams and wish lists, but mm-hmm. by really understanding what is needed in this day and age versus, say, what was going on during the Apollo era?
Mm-hmm. So I'm a huge, not only just space advocate, but planetary settlement advocate. I think what we have to do first is use these commercial lander contracts to begin to get at the surface. Other than the Chinese, we haven't been back to the surface in 40 years, 40-plus years. So I think we have to get on the surface with low-cost technology demonstrators that develop and mature the technologies that we need for planetary settlement, drilling, making bricks, radiation shielding. We are going to settle and have a settlement on Moon and Mars. It's not a question of if, but when. Now, for many people, it's not soon enough. You know, there, even at ISDC with Bob Zubrin, there was the Moon Direct method, which I think makes a lot of sense. Don't do LOPG, but go directly to the Moon. Don't pass go. Don't collect $200. And, you know, I think we have to deal with the realism of the different agencies, including the moon village concept of Europe. And I think the first way to do that is by leveraging these commercial capabilities for access, transportation to the moon, to begin to develop the capabilities for building these settlements. I think that's going to be the first thing that happens. And from that, then, I think we'll move on with creating man-tended settlements initially toward permanent capabilities. But I know there's huge frustration out there. I'm frustrated as well, because I think for many years we have been doing a lot of talking but haven't had the opportunity to begin the flight phase of that. But where I find comfort, where I find great interest and joy now, is that we're beginning to see not only the commercial capability development that's real, that in just a year or two we'll have this transportation system capability that we can take advantage of. But now NASA, through CLPS, is contracting for those capabilities that we can begin doing these flight testing opportunities by 2021. So it's still frustrating that it's not as fast as everyone wants, but even as a planetary settlement advocate and guy, I take great interest and solace that we're beginning now in the next couple of years to actually be doing and not talking about it, at least in these early flights. And as a part of CLPS, I got to say that one of the objectives of the Commercial Lunar Payload Services contract is to also mature technologies for medium lander programs from 500 kilograms up to 5,000 kilogram families that demonstrate the capabilities of these lander systems for large landers at the human lander level. And so that's also, in addition to science and technology, the approach NASA's taking through CLPS is also to mature and develop these technologies for lander systems that we can bring crews as well as heavyweight capabilities down to the outpost. So, yeah, it's frustrating. It's not happening as fast as everyone wants. LOPG has a lot of people that like it and don't like it. But what is real is that we have these emerging commercial lunar lander programs, and NASA is now taking advantage of that with contracts before the end of the year to begin to get some of this early technology down and start testing.
Ben is in Tucson with a question, and he said, many of us still do believe that we could go to Mars, and why do we have to develop these technologies on the moon? Why can't we go to Mars? There's certainly no shortage of people who would go to Mars. And why is the moon the path to Mars, which is simply going to delay us getting to Mars if Mars is the ultimate fruit on the tree? Can't we just figure out a way to maybe develop the technology but go to Mars and not worry about getting bogged down on the moon?
You know, I don't see it bogging down. And I'm in this camp of various engineers, scientists that, as I said, is Mars, but by way of the moon. And I know some people see that in the new agency initiative as a diversion and distraction and ultimately getting to Mars. But, as a former flight director and program manager, it makes a lot of sense to me to do a lot of this development of these capabilities and technologies for Mars, but at the moon. The moon is so close, three days away versus all these 9 months to get there, and it's got the water resources that we can develop and prove how we would use the water for fuel cell reactants and for propellant that we are going to want to do at Mars. Now, some of the technology would be different. Looking at LOX methane and creating the methane out of the carbon dioxide that's at Mars. So there is some apples and orange as we look at technology development of what we could do at the moon versus Mars. But in terms of a lot of the infrastructure capability and construction, and robotic operations and the water for fuel cells, we can do at the moon. And to me, it makes sense of developing all that more cheaply and faster at the moon as we look at how those flow within the technology roadmap for Mars.
This may be the last question if we stick to the hour timeline.
Uh-huh.
So George is in St. Louis, and he said, I've been listening to all this, but here are some facts as I see it. We made lunar landers that worked. We've been on the moon. The lunar landers were terrific. I don't understand what the big deal is. Why can't we just redesign the lunar landers that we built and that have been proven through on-the-job training, so to speak? Why do we have to go through all of this years and years and probably billions and billions of dollars of new research to build a lunar lander? We've already done it, and they worked perfectly.
Yeah, that's a great question, George. And my response to that is that the technology for the moon worked great back in Apollo, but those were one-time use landers. They weren't meant to be refueled, reused. And look at where we've gone with SpaceX in terms of reusability launch vehicles, where you bring them back, you don't throw them away like we did in Apollo, and you refuel and reuse. So the same methodology and technology approach now is becoming infused in the way that we look at architectures for Moon and Mars. So So, yeah, we could recreate the old limb from Northrop Grumman, but the technology that we want is different now for today. We want to be able to refuel and reuse these things, which the limb was not meant to do, and scavenge also the capabilities out of those landers, and also improve the precision landing so that we can appropriately land on these built landing pads and bringing and returning infrastructure from these outposts. So I think being able to use the indigenous material, the volatiles, the water for fuel and propellant that then would resupply and refuel these landers for fuel depots, even if you want, is going to be huge in the way that we rethink of how we do these lander systems. So in many respects, you're right. We could use the old limb systems, but we need to have systems that are reusable and refuelable for Moon and Mars in the future, as an example of how that's going to be different.
We are at the hour point, and what we need to do is bring you back for a full program and let you face the listeners, so to speak, because these are fascinating topics. Anything you want us to hold on to or any takeaways, given our hour discussion, anything we forgot perhaps that is important to mention?
No, I think the main takeaway for me, what helps my frustration and maybe many of your listeners, is that we're at the advent in the next couple of years of being back on the surface where we have not been for 40 plus years. And I think it is through the advent of these commercial lunar lander programs and the CLPS program that NASA's putting in place to take advantage of those commercial lunar lander programs and beginning to access the surface for the first time. And that's not wish and dream and hopeful that that'll be in 20 years. That's in the next 2 years. And I think that gives us a foothold, a beginning to re-engaging the surface, which we have not done for so long, which has been a frustration. So that's where I take solace, where I take comfort, that this is really going to happen in the next couple of years. And then we see how that advance into larger programs of human landers in getting back and creating more permanent outposts and settlements on the moon, and then applying that for capabilities on Mars. That's the key takeaway, I think.
Real quick, Linda in Portland, Oregon sent in a note and said, perhaps, David, you can squeeze this one in. China says they're going back to the moon. Many people think China will beat us back to the moon. They're going to land on the moon. And here's the thing. They're probably not doing anything that what you're talking about, Rob. They're just going to go to the moon and land on the moon. Do I have that right about China? Is there any reason to be concerned about them going back to the moon? Do they need the same kind of technology that we're talking about building?
I think it's great that they're going back. You know, they've got a relay satellite for the far side that they've just put on location that'll support a far side lander, which is a redo of what they flew to the moon back in end of 2013. So that will be the first time we've ever had any asset landers on the far side of the moon. I think that's tremendous. And obviously, they're also looking at a sample return mission. We also are looking at sample return within the NASA agency. So I don't see concern of China going. But in addition to the Chinese, we have various international groups, including India and Russia and others, in addition to American commercial companies that are building these landers that, you know, now we're actually seeing this happen and not wishing and hoping for it. So, again, I think this is a great time of re-engaging the moon.
Are China and these other participants talking about all these flight demonstrators and trying to resolve issues that, like you talked about during the first half of our show?
Yeah, that I don't know. I mean, they're developing landing capabilities. I think they're interested in a lot of the science for volatiles and the science of the moon. I'm pushing on to broaden the portfolio that we just don't do science, but we also do technology development. And maybe we can fly some of those on Chinese landers as well. So these commercial companies, Chinese and others, are developing the lander capabilities, and then it's up to others to figure out what kind of payloads and instruments we want to fly that complement both a portfolio of science, of engineering, and technology.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, but we need to bring you back on again for a full program, if you're willing, and go into this a lot deeper, okay?
Yeah, it was so much fun to come and share again on your program. I'm a listener and supporter and love the program, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to come and sharing some of this with your group today.
Well, we'll get you back on again this year and go into some of this in more detail, and I look forward to it. And I want to thank you. I know you're traveling and your time is limited, and I appreciate your being able to give us this hour this morning.
Great. And thanks again. Have a great day, David.
You too. And listeners, back on Friday and Sunday for more Space Show programs. Everybody have a great day, a great week. Keep looking up. Goodbye from Rob Kelso, David, and the Space Show.